Good morning, good afternoon, good day to everybody who may be joining us in the out in the universe. And I'm happy to see all of you all. Welcome to Creating the Futures Board meeting for March of 2019, which is unbelievable. Let's go around and if you'll share who you are and as is our practice, to share what is awesome, what has been awesome in your life recently. If anyone is watching along and tweeting, please tweet to the hashtag creating the future. If you post it at the blog or you post it anywhere else, we won't see it because we're only looking at that one place on Twitter. And so if you'll post to the hashtag creating the future, and as we're sharing what's awesome in our life, please share what's awesome in your lives. So I am Hilde Gottlieb. I'll go last. who wants to start with what's been awesome in your life?
Oh,
Carl, you're here at the beginning. I'm so happy. I'm
here. Now, that's my awesome, is seeing Carl.
I know, and you're looking dapper. Look at this. This is a new do.
Is it? Hi, everyone. Good to see you all.
Hey, we are just starting out, introducing ourselves, saying our name, and something awesome. So whoever wants to start, Carl, you can get warmed up and start in later, but who wants to start with what's been awesome in your life?
I can start. So Justin Pollock, I'm in Washington, D.C. So the really pragmatic awesome is I finished my taxes. So that's always a nice thing just to have done. The more awesome is that about 2 weeks ago, I was sitting down to do sort of my mental calisthenics that I do and looking over stuff that I've written and developed, and had a couple of really key aha moments as focused in on actually the piece that I shared with all of you, this capacity model piece. So that was pretty awesome. And then I was inspired to start writing some things, and that's always good. So,
oh, good. I'm always inspired when you're inspired to write. Yay. Wonderful, wonderful. Who else? What's been awesome in your lives?
I'll go next. My name's Angie Eikenberry. I'm in Omaha, Nebraska, and I work at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. And one of my awesomes is that we went to see Apollo 11 on Friday. Have any of you seen that yet? Mm-hmm. The new documentary, kind of a lot of new documentary, I guess, footage that you haven't really seen before. And it's just, it's amazing what we did, you know, to get to make that happen. So really, yeah. So I just think like there are awesome things that we can do if we set our minds to it. And that movie really shows it in spades. And and then my other personal awesome is the snow is melting, and maybe it will be the last of the snow, I hope. I'm really hoping. And it's good to see all of you.
So I'll go next. So I'm Carl Wilding. I'm based just outside London in the UK, and I'm creating the future's European representative when Angie Eikenberry isn't here. My awesome is personal one, and that is at Christmas I started running again. I got into running for the first time in 40 years about 2 years ago, and I just started again, and I managed to do a half marathon in 2 hours and 3 minutes, which I'm dead pleased with.
Wow.
Good job.
Yeah. Wow. Awesome. No wonder you're looking so good there, Mr. Wilding. It's agreeing with you.
Ah, cool. I lost you for a second then. Life is good.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. Yes, absolutely. For anybody that may be watching, Justin texted us a note that he's going dark for a moment so that he can eat. Because apparently nobody wants to see anybody eating ever, but that's okay. So thank you. Rebecca, what's going on with you? That's awesome.
Hi, everyone. Rebecca. I'm in McCall, Idaho, and we have a Second Sundays concert series at our free community concerts in our very teeny town. We're actually resource rich in a million different ways. So last night we heard an extraordinary classical guitarist named Tomas Rodriguez, and I suggest you YouTube him if you'd be interested, as he brought in so many different original sources of music from Africa, South America, and he talked throughout. So there was no handout of this is the songs I'm going to play. He gave us the narrative as the on-ramp to each piece. And it's pretty wonderful to get to go to a concert like that if you have any sense that I live in a really, really small mountain town and this goes on every month here, so.
Wow. Oh, it sounds wonderful.
It does.
It sounds wonderful. Scott must have loved that.
He did. He was in awe of how far this man could stretch his fingers across at least six frets.
Wow.
Sort of like a five octave.
Dimitri?
My awesome. Hi, I'm Dimitri Petropoulos. I'm from Arizona with Creating the Future. And my awesome is all around searching for poppies, searching for flowers. The wildflowers have been blooming like crazy. That you've had a ton of rain and more rain scheduled, and we're in the desert, so this is like some of it is normal, but a lot of it is not. We ran out on Saturday to see if we could find some wildflowers, and the place we went didn't have any. And we ended up at Kitt Peak Observatory, which was in that area. And it was just amazing to be up at 7,000 feet looking out over valleys and clouds and whatever. And there was still some snow up there. So pretty neat for this far south to still have some. There's still snow on the mountains around Tucson right now. So that, my awesome is being in nature and being able to have flowers. There was more adventures with flowers, but I don't want to bore you with that. With flowers. That's my awesome.
That is awesome. And it was awesome. And I'm Hilde Gottlieb with Creating the Future, and I am in Tucson, Arizona, and more flowers. The weekend was a delicious mix of nature and people. We spent time out looking, searching for wildflowers with my best friend. We got to have two delightful dinners with amazing people and got to just, I mean, we just spent a lot of time with people that we love this weekend. So that was really, really pretty awesome. It all just sort of filled your heart. So yeah, it's pretty nice. We don't often get to jam that much. Saturday, we actually had three different times with three different people that we love. And so we don't normally get to do that. So that was pretty fun. Pretty fun. And the flowers are beautiful. So we should probably share photos of the flowers, but then we'll completely bore everybody. They're like, all right, it's flowers, we get it. So today, diving in, I also have to say that one of my awesomes is I've been really excited about this particular meeting. Not that I don't love all of our meetings and love to be with you guys, we have been talking theoretical, pulling together what kind of structure will carry Creating the Future's mission forward. We've been talking about this for a long time, and we are at the point where we're building it. And to actually start the practical conversations using the catalytic thinking framework, but the practical conversations of what does this thing need to do and be, and who'll do what, and so I've just been very, very excited for this meeting. So you guys are another one of my awesomes. For just a little bit of review, I realized that I wish that I had attached this to the agenda, and I will retroactively go back and attach it to the blog post to make sure that people can see it. But I want to remind us of the catalytic thinking framework, so that we all know what we're going to be doing and where we're going to be going here. When any situation presents itself, we have the opportunity to either react to that situation or create what is possible. And we are going to be creating what is possible. The the left-hand column here is really all about that tenet of catalytic thinking that says it's always about the people. We're so good as humans at getting into the stuff, the roles and the functions, and but it's really about the people and how the people feel and how they'll be affected by anything that we do. And so you'll notice up here in this box here that says for whom, we're going to be talking today, starting with, you know, whose lives are going to be affected by anything that we do, any actions that we take. And what we find is if we don't ask that for whom question and we just dive into the stuff, we are pretty much guaranteed to have unintended consequences just because we're not asking the question. So unintended consequences are not necessarily a given. We just don't ask the question. And then, oh, look, they happen. So we're going to be asking about all of those for whoms and listening to what are the values and the outcomes that will be evident as we have the conversation. If we have time, we'll start reaching for what could be possible for those individuals. But the most important questions that we can be asking today are in this left-hand column here of who will be impacted by anything we do and what is important to them. So one of the thoughts that I had, and I just sort of wanted to share it as we start. We have been, and so to folks who've not been along the journey as we are very inside baseball at this point with this conversation here. Creating the Future has been talking for several years about around the question of what organizational structure would propel missions forward. If there was no such thing as organizations as they currently exist, what would we build to propel social missions forward? And we would like to build that and experiment with it and see what it feels like inside of it and study it and share what we're learning as we go. And the model that we have been looking at is a networked platform that where rather than everyone being accountable to the organization, that the organization really is accountable to making sure that change is happening out in the world with the people that are actually creating the change. And what that means for the board is we've talked about being loosely a compliance-focused board. We haven't defined what that means. Well, that's where we're diving in now. But we've really been talking about having the board, because there really isn't a lot legally that anything says this is what a board must do. We do know that what a board must do is make sure that we're legal. And compliance, legal is the tiny little nut of compliance. And as we talk about compliance more and more and more, that's where we're going to be focusing on is what really does compliance mean? And one of the thoughts that I've had in thinking about this, oh, let's say nonstop for the past couple of years, I feel like compliance is about expectations, is about who has expectations of an organization? Whose expectations must we comply with? Because when we think about legal compliance, we're thinking about complying to someone's expectations of us. And so that's, it's just been a word that's sort of been mulling in my mind as we start to think about, you know, compliance to whom, about what really in my mind sort of settles with expectations. And if you're willing to play with me a little bit on that, if we were to look at that box of for whoms, whose expectations must we comply with? And I already kicked it off with you know, state law, federal law, the IRS. Let's get them out of the way. Those are the bare minimums.
So I guess, you know, as you are, Hildy, sort of riffing off the idea of compliance, that I'd like to add a sort of a nuance to it, which really is more about, you know, we're complying with commitments. So it's really sort of asking, you know, because that's your risk. You know, risk is really the failure to meet a commitment. I mean, that's what it is, and which I think has a lot to do with people's expectations. So if there's sort of that question of what are the commitments that the organization is making by being organized, I mean, that's the corporate structure, but also what are the other elements that we're inherently bringing on as the expect, and maybe that's the expected commitments that we have as an organization. And then sort of the compliance is, you know, how are we ensuring that those commitments are being met, that's there. So I don't know. I mean, that's just sort of how my brain thinks about it. And it also thinks about it. It also has, to me, a more human element to it, because humans make commitments. You know, it's a human thing to make commitments. It's not really human to comply. And certainly when we use it, when we put those two together, it's like, that feels a little icky.
Yeah, that's why expectations felt better to me as well. And I think they are. They're expectations and commitments, but I think those go hand in hand. I like that. So whose expectations are we complying with? Whose commitments? Who are we committed to?
Obviously, the external factors that
okay.
you mentioned.
And remember to speak up.
You know, obviously, the external factors, the legal compliance of what society is putting on the organization, society, both legally, and maybe expectation-wise. You're an XYZ kind of organization. Therefore, my expectation is you do the following, or you commit to the following, or you follow through the following. And then the internal commitments and the internal expectations, what do we set for ourselves? And you know, what does the organization set for itself in terms of the expectation? You know, keeping in mind all of the functions that an organization has and all of the things that it needs to do.
Yep. Who within that? So if we're looking at external expectations, people outside the organization, and I don't necessarily like outside and inside because we're really not talking about something that has walls around it. We're really talking about a permeable membrane that is networked out in the world.
And I guess what I meant by that is expectations that come from generated by ourselves.
No, I get that. I get that. And I'd like to go into, like, who are those outside? Okay, so... So who?
So some of those are simply the entities around which the organizational structure is defined. So what I mean by that is, you know, by opting to be a 501c3, and you know, so we first have at the state level a corporation. So by opting to be a corporation, in this case, I assume it's incorporated in Arizona. So you know, there are commitments that need to be met with regard to what the requirements of being that legal entity are at the state level. And then likewise, so that's actually not the 501c3, that's whatever the state is calling this kind of for benefit type organization. At the federal level, we have the IRS that is interested in ensuring that the commitment to a particular type of business outcomes is in alignment with what the IRS considers a tax-exempt activity. I mean, that's, you know, again, sort of the specific. So I think at the basics, we have that, which is we need to ensure that our commitment to do something that's considered beneficial and tax-exempt, that's the obligation we have to the IRS, as well as the annual financial filing obligations to sustain status. And then likewise, whatever is sort of the parallel at the state level, which is what's the paperwork requirement in terms of forms and such like that to sustain the corporate entity, what fees may be associated with that, those types of things, you know, is the, what's, you know, are there issues of being incorporated and being an operating business in Tucson? So there's then the local, I mean, there's sort of all these different elements of the legal business structure. So if we're thinking about the people, you know, once all the forms get through the AI systems, are they getting to, you know, do they make sense to somebody who's going to read it?
Well, and that leads to who else is going to read it. So, you know, you've got the 990, so following that money trail, we've got the 990 that once it is filed with the IRS gets posted on our website. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that sort of, so who would be following that money trail? And again, what are, you know, whose expectations and commitments are those?
It would be potential partners who are going to want to take a look at whether they know Creating the Future well or someone told them about them. The go-to is, I want to check them out. And the 990 is a place people go to try to glean a story.
Yeah. Partners in what? Define partners.
I would say in the broadest way possible, you know, someone, a organization or a human being who may want to come spend time with Creating the Future, to partner on a project or educational programs or fill in the blank with anything. Just, is this organization someone, even from the outside, with me doing all my outside research, I feel good about, however that person is defining good, comfortable, confident in this being a, however that person is defining, credible and legit in that person's world.
Right. Who else? I mean, that sort of raises, as we've been talking about funding, in a partnership way. I think there's clearly expectations and commitments to our donors, funders, and anyone providing financial support, and then anyone providing any other support, resource support, volunteering, being part of. And I would almost put funders and donors separate, because they may have different expectations.
I mean, just sort of as a small side note there, we know journalists and news entities look at those 990s when they're curious about, you know, doing their research.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, again, could sort of extend out to anybody who is potentially doing research around the work that the organization is engaged in.
Yeah, that's big. And considering that we are hoping that more and more people will take a look at what we're doing and do some research, I think that's big, Justin, yeah.
Whomever is going to be on this future state of the board.
Yeah.
Who's going to say, sign me up?
Yeah. And you know, that sort of leads into, Dimitri was talking sort of internal, external, employees, contractors, vendors.
Say, sort of in broad categories, which captures some of what you were talking about, sort of who are all the people that contribute assets to the organization?
Yes.
And assets being more than just financial. I mean, you talked about time, energy, intellect, you know, whatever it is. But if we sort of identify who is it that's contributing, in essence, making an investment in the organization of something of value to them.
Yes.
And then also, who are the, so if we're continuing down that sort of line of thinking, who are the asset utilizers? So who is it that is actually depending on the assets that are being held and shepherded by the organization? So that could be staff, volunteers, you know, the people who are who have the potential to be dependent on the system and the asset themselves. So participants in training, people going to the website looking for inspiration and ideas.
Yeah, I don't want to gloss over, you included them in a big basket, but I want to pull out participants in education programs, participants in any of our programs. You know, one of the many people with whom we hung out this weekend was someone who happened to be in town. We've never met in person, has been in our Facebook group for consultants. And we know that that group has very specific expectations and that we have made commitments to that group to nurture. And so I think that there's a big piece there, Justin, in the participants in general. Thank you for that.
And when Justin, you had talked with research around the organization's work, it's even anyone who's out there doing research and there has to be a different way, or I want to find a different way to structure toward mission. Where are the examples in the world?
Yeah.
I'm also trying to give you a commitment to self being your organization. And that if there's expectations and commitments, all of these are with partners, all of these are with entities other than creating the future. So there's kind of an internal commitment to the mission, internal commitment.
Mission. Yeah. Absolutely.
Maybe I can jump into just the thought that maybe I hope doesn't side-rail us too much, but I was just thinking about a lot of what we've been talking about seems to be reacting to, it sounds like we're kind of reacting to what other people expect or, and I'm wondering if there's a way to think about it in a more, I guess, proactive, you know, creating those mutual expectations, commitments. I know there's certain limitations to that when you get to state, federal, IRS, but that, you know, reacting to those expectations sometimes I think has gotten us into why we sometimes are limited in what we can achieve.
Yeah.
So reframing that, I don't know, somehow.
Well, and that's exactly what we'll be doing. Exactly what we'll be doing. The next question that we're going to be playing with is, okay, if all of these people have expectations, what are those expectations and what's important about them? Somebody who has, for instance, the IRS may have an expectation that you don't mess up. Okay, if that's what they don't want, what do they want? So flipping that question, Angie, to looking at each of these and saying, what are their expectations? And what do they really want? So let's dive into, I've been so mindful lately, I just need to share with you all, a lot of what we talk about, especially in our education programs, is the fact that we in our modern language, at least in English, we frame so much in the negative that we mean in the positive. And so it'll be like, don't forget to, rather than remember to. And we're constantly in this negative framing, and one that has been gnawing at me, and I hear it come out of my mouth, and the minute I hear it come out of my mouth, I want to pull it back, is why don't we? When what we really want to do is let's. So let's dive in rather. Why don't we dive in? You had your aside, Angie. I had my aside. So let's talk about some of these. What are the expectations? Let's do what appear to be the easy ones first. The IRS at the federal level, the state law, at the state level. And Justin, there are no local laws, at least not that we know of. Not that our attorney has made us aware of, I shall put it that way. But what are the expectations of, let's start with the gods that everyone seems to bow down to, the IRS.
I don't think there's actually that many ultimately expectations besides filing your whatever, either the short form or the long form. Mm-hmm. It's not even clear people in the IRS these days really look that closely at any of the documentation. I think we do a lot of, we self-monitor more than they do, I think, regarding.
So I always like, when I talk to people about this, because we use that terminology, the 501c3, I like to tell people that's a paragraph in the IRS tax code. So what the IRS needs is, or what is most beneficial to them is demonstrative clear evidence that you fit in that description of charitable acts or exempt acts. So I think to Angie's point, yeah, they don't look at it, but if they have to, if someone says, well, what about creating the future? What we want to make sure they have is something that just makes it crystal clear that we fit in that paragraph description, that we are in alignment with it. And then I echo, Angie, what you were saying. They want the forms filed. They want the, there are a couple of other little, regulations around, personal inurement, and they need demonstrable evidence that, again, sort of their parameters of what is considered charitable and exempt are being met.
Right. That this is not set up to benefit individuals, that et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. You don't understand inurement.
Yeah. The issues around pay, executive pay, there are some.
Mm-hmm.
And so on, but yeah.
Yeah, and it was interesting. Justin and I spent a good chunk of last year talking to experts around compliance, talking with our attorney, and it is remarkable how little is positively required. So state law, I think, is sort of the same. It's from what I understand, the expectation of state law is all in the negative, that you won't do something illegal.
There's an annual filing, just like there is in the feds. So their part of their expectation is on X date, they're going to see this form with a fee, if there's a fee, filed, proving you're still a corporation, that you're still complying with corporate their version of corporate rules. You have a board meeting, whatever that goes on. I'm also thinking that in both of those cases, they are central locations of data that anybody can access about the organization. So you could go to the state corporation commission and you can type creating the future and it will pop up as creating the future and you will see that it exists. Same thing with the 990. So they are, it's not their expectation, but it's others' expectation on us for them, that information will be there and they can access.
So there's an element, actually, going back to what it sort of triggered, I think, in connection to also what you were saying, Dimitri and Angie, around when we make the option to incorporate, we define the corporation through the articles of incorporation and the bylaws. And so I'm making an assumption that, the Secretary of State is going to want to know that an organization is in compliance with its articles of incorporation and its bylaws, meaning that it's following them. Because if there's a, it's sort of like we have some basic rules, and part of those basic rules are you need to set up your rules And so the, I mean, it's sort of a stretch, but it's kind of saying there's an expectation on this by the state that you will set up some rules for how you organize your organization, and you will ensure that you are in alignment with those expectations.
And interestingly, with no legal requirement to file your bylaws, so they don't know if you're in compliance or not. When they do know is when you're in court and they ask you, do you have your bylaws and were you following them? So it's sort of a retroactive thing that happens when you mess up and when you wind up in court. That's where, so I think the expectation is very, very, very real, Justin. I'm also thinking about the state has a requirement of a minimum number of board members. So they expect you to have that minimum number of board members, which in Arizona is one.
The board member.
Yeah.
So you do file your articles of incorporation. Part of incorporating, is filing, annual filings, but the initial incorporation is you have your articles of incorporation.
Yeah. Well, and that also leads to some of the stuff that comes under that broad heading that you were mentioning, Justin, that demonstrative evidence that you actually fit the paragraph. If you only had one board member, the IRS would not be happy. So there is an expectation of, it may be nebulous, but there's some sort of expectation of shared leadership. Again, that evidence is that this is not just one person's thing, that this is a community thing.
Yeah. The IRS does ask for your bylaws under certain circumstances, that you are required to file them with the IRS. And I think it is along those lines, which is they want demonstrable evidence that you are working sort of independent of individuals.
Right.
And I think from the IRS standpoint, and probably the state standpoint, they actually want evidence that you are working, that you are actually going entity.
Yeah.
So.
Yes. The state doesn't, I will tell you, the form that we fill out is literally around who owns the corporation. And then when you say, nobody really owns it, then, that's about it.
Well, there's always the questions of, have you ever heard of bankruptcy? Have you ever been arrested for a felony of stealing money? So, I mean, it's all.
And those
around.
Are board, right.
Those are
right.
All around.
The board members, yep.
It does strike me that for the most part, these entities that we're talking about are relatively straightforward.
Very much.
And they actually, I mean, I know I use commitment, but I do think that in this realm, it is really a lot more of just compliance with what they ask for.
Yes.
Yes. It's neither, well, to me, let me be very clear, to me, it's neither interesting nor that complex if you're straightforward about it. You know, so, you know, I think that there is, again, you have to come at it, I think, a little bit from the negative side, but they want to make sure you're not gaming the system to claim something that you're not, you know, but I would assume they would rather not have to bust people and catch people. They would rather just go forward and let it be.
Yeah, I agree. So then let's move on to, we can parse it, or I liked the way that you talked about, Justin, people investing in the mission, contributing their assets, which could be foundations, it could be donors, it could be people, volunteers, it could be people sharing in kind, it could be people who are sharing who they are and what they have with the organization. We can parse that as we need to, but people sharing assets to invest in the mission. I really, really like that phrasing, Justin. What are our commitments to them? What are their expectations? Well, I think one of them is one that you mentioned, the whole thing, Justin, about evidence that we're actually doing what we said we're going to do.
Yeah, so I mean, I think there's the obvious one that should be noted clearly is whatever we claim as an outcome is being advanced. So that's the ultimate return on that investment of asset is that it's contributing to an outcome that's clear, agreed upon,
What else are those expectations and commitments to donors and funders and volunteers and people sharing their wisdom and selves and assets with Creating the Future?
So it's a really interesting conversation. I've been sort of thinking a bit about a lot of the stuff that's going on in the UK at the minute that's related to this. And one sort of big inquiry into the future of civil society talks about power and the fact that actually what people want now is that they want us to share power. They want those with power to sort of share it. And in this relationship, we are people with power. I think secondly, they want us to be accountable, which is what you've been talking about, but they don't want us to be accountable upwards to the IRS, as you've been talking about. They want us to be accountable to the communities that we serve. So I guess what I'm saying there is that I'm not necessarily sure that those people who are sharing things with us want us to be accountable to them. They want us to be accountable downwards for our mission, and they want us to show that actually we're collectively doing something. And I think they want to trust us. And I guess where we have to be slightly cautious about some of the conversation that I think we've had is that it's looking at us through the lens of IRS and those power structures who don't trust us, actually. And I think at our best, the sort of stuff that we want to model, it's about how do we build trusting, powerful relationships, which is not about some of the things that we've been talking about in sort of the IRS forms. I don't quite know what the answer is, but
talk more about trust, and anybody jump in. Talk more about trust us to do or be what.
So just before I talk about trust, I missed the C out, I've just realized in when I talked about that inquiry. So it's called the PACT framework. It talks about power and giving people more control over their own lives. I'll come on to in a minute. We also talked about connection, mm-hmm. and broadening and deepening our connections with people and communities, which I think is what Creating the Future is all about. So these should be mechanisms that help us create connections with people. The trust one is interesting because when we talk about trust a lot of the time, we talk about the public at large don't trust charities, or they don't trust nonprofits, or the IRS don't trust us. And actually, one of the things that certainly we found in the UK when you start asking people is that actually there's a lot of mistrust within the nonprofit sector. And actually, there are things that we've got to do there to build trust within our sector or within that community of consultants or whatever before we even start talking about anyone else trusting us. So what I'm sort of thinking there is on the trust thing is that how many times have we found ourselves in situations with funders where we've had a funding decision and it's left us sort of feeling, well, actually, I don't really trust you and the reason that you're giving me for the decision that you've come to.
I just added into the list of people with expectations, other organizations. So thank you, Carl.
Yeah, just one last thing on the sort of the fundus thing, and again, it all sort of comes back to sort of power. I heard another thing recently that sort of said funders really need to do something to reduce the social distance that they have between themselves and the organisations that they fund, and I think that's really interesting. And I think again, it sort of that sort of thinking applies to us, which is how do these sort of mechanisms like governance, like the information that we provide, how do they reduce the social distance between us and the people that we seek to benefit?
Yeah.
I'll shut up now.
Never. We love when you talk. Other things that people who are investing and sharing their assets to further the mission, what are other expectations and commitments?
So, I think from the institutional entities, so, you know, foundations, governments that, you know, that are sort of buying in, either contracting for or granting. And again, I'm very cognizant of what you said, Hilde, in terms of the negative framing, but I think this is another one of, they will trust that you won't burn me. So this idea that, you know, particularly I hear this when I speak to people who are in government, they're like, we're audited nonstop, 100% of the time. If you screw up, we get hit, we get dinged. So what they want to trust is that you, you know, as much as it is, yes, they want outcomes and they want those to be effective and efficient. They don't want you to burn them. You don't want that. Don't be a black mark on us because you screw something up. And I think that's, you know, with what Carl was saying about funders who don't have trust, that I think is some of it, is they don't trust that you're not going to screw up. They don't trust that you're actually going to fulfill what you say you're going to fulfill for whatever reasons it might be, but either they don't have confidence because they don't know you, they look at a track, whatever it is. So I think there's a strong element on the institutional side. We don't want you to burn us. I think for others, you know, for donors, contributors, the volunteers, the in-kind folks, who the blemish isn't the issue. I mean, you know, if I donate to an organization, I'm not concerned that I'm going to be brought down if something goes wrong with them. What I hear people really say is the crux of it, particularly people who are giving financial donations. Are you effective and efficient at advancing your outcomes? Are you best in class? Can I understand how you do your work so I can judge if it's worthwhile for me to invest in you because of what I want to see done in the community? So I think that's the effective and efficient I don't want to say execution of your mission, but the carrying out of the things that need outcomes.
Yes, Mr. Wiley.
What Justin just said about being burned, I think is critical. We seem to live in a society now where we think that we can eradicate risk from how we fund, from what we do, from how we live our lives, and we can't. And it strikes me that the best organisations and the best funders now are the ones that are brave and come out and talk about their failure. So you have organisations like Engineers Without Borders in Canada that produces a failure report every year and talks about the things that went wrong so that we can learn from their failures. So when you talk about modelling, Hilde, about what is the best that we could be and how do we change the questions and so on, that's the sort of thinking that I think that this could be. It's about talking about all the things that we did and to sort of set that message. Actually, if you want to be innovative, if you want change, by definition, you can't only fund things that always work.
Yep. Well, and what you're raising really is a huge expectation, which is honesty, transparency, openness. Huge.
And sorry, just there, and if I may, and again, I'm not sure I'm very lucid about this, but openness and transparency are not the same thing.
Right.
What the IRS is expecting of you is transparency. That will get you so far, but I don't think transparency will build trust. Right. Openness will build trust. They're not the same thing.
Yeah. Demetrio had a beautiful analogy. When we first started streaming and inviting people into our meetings, you know, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, whenever it was, Demetri's analogy is that a window is transparent. You can see through it, but you can only see what I have put out there for you to see. And you can't walk in that window because it's there, but you can see in. And that open, you can walk in the door, you can move the furniture around, you can, and I loved that analogy. That open is open. Yeah, yeah.
Just a comment on the failure report. In thinking of it, it's, I would look at it as learnings. What did we learn versus what did we succeed at? You know, they're both positive, as opposed to one's negative or one's positive. Because it's really, when you are announcing that, you're announcing, these are things I learned. I learned you can't do this, or that they, you know, without supports, the building falls down, or, you know, whatever it is you learned. And because I think failure in our culture, that language has such a connotation. And even there's been such an effort to try to make failure, you know, fail fast and do whatever, it's still a very negative idea that you failed, you did not succeed, as opposed to I learned, you know, I'm moving closer to success by doing that.
Applying the neuroscience behind catalytic thinking, actually speaking about failure triggers the fear center in the brain. Speaking about learning does not. It's the exact same thing. We're reporting the exact same things. When we talk about being open about failure, your brain automatically goes to that place, and we have to work extra hard to move it forward. It's amazing how language is a trigger in that way. One of the things that you mentioned, Carl, was connection. And I want to go back to that. And I like, Justin, the separation of the institutional versus the individual, because while an individual donor may not necessarily have an expectation of connection, of personal connection. They appreciate the personal connection. So that, again, that tenet that it is not about the thing, it's about the people, that it's not about your money. It's not about your car that you donated or your, it's about that connection. And I think that it's not necessarily an expectation. It's not necessarily a commitment that they are expecting, but that over and above that, in the plus one rather than the minus one, it is definitely something that is so deeply appreciated. That you're a human. Oh, you happen to be helping us with this thing, but the most important thing to me is that I think you are awesome.
I was thinking of as people are contributing, you know, who they are and the assets they have, all forms, is even. And then what can I expect about my role with the people within this organization? Because how are decisions made? Am I a part of those decisions? What does contribution look like, to what end, beyond the stuff I'm sharing? You know, how am I participating?
What other expectations do institutional contributors, investors have, foundations specifically?
In meeting them where they are in the systems they're in, show me the report of how you spent the money. You know, like, I want to see the documented progress reports down to the dollar.
In some cases, I do like what you prefaced it with, which is meeting them where they are with what they want. Yeah. And depending on what that thing is, It may be report this down to the dollar. It may be, I just want to know you did good stuff. Let's have a conversation. Yeah, yeah.
And it's this organization's willingness to meet them where they're at in that system is, it may be the very detailed reports if we're choosing to partner.
And I think Rebecca is completely right there, but if I'm going to follow our catalytic thinking approach, do we change our assumptions? Because that sort of thinking where funders want you to report against their outcomes rather than ask you about your outcomes, that's the sort of stuff, is it, that we might want to change?
Yeah.
These sort of endless sort of meeting funders sort of commitments that legitimize the sort of structures that we're trying to get rid of.
Exactly. Well, and you all have been on the board long enough to know that that is why we have not sought funding from foundations. That it is why this year my job is to find foundations who actually want to partner with us as equals and have conversation rather than exactly what Rebecca and Carl, you are talking about. It's why we have been lean for all of these years. Because we have not wanted to walk into that realm.
So if we frame this as what we can do as an organization, so one of the commitments that we want to hold ourselves to, I think it is a commitment to ensuring that those who invest are benefiting from investing. And the thing about that is that's a big question mark. It's going to vary. So our commitment is to ask that question of, is someone benefiting from that? So if someone volunteers, what's the benefit they're expecting from that investment? And are they getting it? And so I think that even goes back to what Rebecca was saying, was if a funder has a set of, you know, expectations of the way that they will benefit, even if we disagree, you know, sort of by agreeing to engage with them, we are agreeing and committing to assessing, monitoring, asking questions about the benefit they're hoping for and the role we play in supporting that. So, I mean, think about, you know, how many organizations ask, how does our staff benefit from being employed by us?
Right.
You know, beyond, will they get a salary and the joy of working here? You know, or maybe, you know, a good organization will say they get professional development. Very few do I hear who are saying when they go home from night at night, they're going to be excited and engaged and feel honored from their day at work. You know, but that's the kind of thing that I think if we look at what is the system that allows us to commit to people benefiting from the investment they make in this organization.
I'm the only thing that I'm that makes me nervous is the word benefit, just because it triggers all of the private inurement sort of thoughts about, oh, you cannot personally benefit. As a quote unquote investor in a community benefit nonprofit 501c3 tax exempt organization, you cannot personally benefit. So finding a different word would make me more comfortable just in terms of how it is construed. I agree with the concept. I'm just for anybody listening who is also bristling, I just wanted to but I do agree conceptually, Dustin, absolutely. Angie, yeah.
Well, I'm wondering about more than the word itself, that I know personally I invest in this organization not for my own benefit. I mean, maybe I do, you know, benefit in some ways, but that's not why I do it. And I mean, I'm interested in creating larger change that would actually hopefully lead to things that would work against my benefit, actually, would probably would be good. So I wonder, yeah, I'm a little bit worried about going down that path too much. Maybe, you know, people have different motivations, I guess. I don't care about efficiency. I don't even really care about effectiveness in a short-term way. And I'm, you know, and if we're about creative, we're investing in a vision for a future or ways to think about changing things, then those metrics don't work very well, it seems to me.
Well, and that's where I think the response that both of you are having is evidence to me of us being able to reframe this conversation, because that is a benefit to you, Angie. I mean, some of the things that you're talking about might be, you know, I may have less power. I might now live in a society where, as the white male, I don't get all the advantage that is granted upon me. Yet that is an aspiration of mine, is that we have a community that is like that. So the benefit to me is knowing that I'm contributing into a system that has the potential to make that kind of change. So I think that we need to, that whole question of benefit is, it isn't. And this is why I had it as a big question mark. We need to be able to explore. People are not here simply for the benefit of others. They are that my desire to benefit others is fulfilling something in me that I want. And it might not be a tangible, I walk away with this, but it may be the ripple out I feel, the influence that I can bring, the support I can give. But to recognize that's what I expect. I expect to feel like I've contributed, and to not recognize. So we have to figure out how do we capture that, and then.
Yeah. Carl, go ahead.
I don't think Angie and Justin are very far apart, actually. But I think what both of them are talking about is public benefit. I think the challenge that we have to face, though, is that the people who are setting the metrics, as Angie is saying, are not the people on the ground. They're not the communities that we're serving. They're the funders, and it's their metrics and so on. So the challenge for us in any sort of reporting and outcome measurement here is how do we report through the voices and through the lived experience of those people who are on the ground, because they should be the arbiters of what's impactful, not a foundation in Washington.
Yeah. Well, and Justin, where my brain was going as you and Angie were talking, is maybe what we're really talking about, and it was the first thing we said, is evidence that we're doing what we said we'll do. And what that gets to is the why. And what you're really reaching at is the layer down from that is furthering something that is important to me. And so it may be important to me because I personally want to be able to take classes at Creating the Future Forever. And the classes have benefited me. Or it could be important to me because I want to blow things up and start over again and make everything way, way better. And I think it's sort of getting to the why of what is important about the fact that we've said we're doing what we said we were going to do. We'll keep moving on this one. I'd like to move along to partners and potential partners. What are the expectations and commitments to potential partners? We have in the past partnered with the Pennsylvania Association for Nonprofits. We have partnered with the Nevada Department of Education. I'm sort of looking at the fact that we want to be partnering with funders in the future in more of a partnership way than a we are complying with your expectations way. We are talking about another fairly large potential partnership currently with another organization. Groups that we are doing demonstration projects with, partnering side by side with, melding our assets and creating something that neither of us could accomplish on our own. What are the expectations and commitments of those partners upon us? I'm going to start with that we'll do what we said we'll do. whatever that is in that circumstance.
I'm also thinking about defining partner. Mm-hmm. Because so often the word, especially when you're talking about a funding type relationship, a partner doesn't mean the same thing traditionally. It means I'm giving you this, you're doing that.
Right.
And to me, a partner is there's a give and take that goes on between them, and that they both benefit and they both risk. When they get into that.
So then let's leave our desire for funding partners out and just look at demonstration partners, which quite honestly, those funding partners will be. But let's look at partners in demonstration projects, if that helps to clarify. Thank you, Dimitri.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Carl, we can't hear you.
Sorry. When I think about our situation here at the moment, I think the first thing that sort of funders almost want you to be now, to coin a phrase, is catalytic. They want you to unlock time or talent or resources from somewhere else because they recognize that they can't do it on their own. But I think funders increasingly are thinking about the scale of the social economic problems that we're facing now, and I think they're increasingly conscious that they can't solve them. And I think the second thing, just thinking out aloud, Hildy, and again sort of challenge me here, is I heard an expression a few years ago that the sort of the funding model works on this idea of pump priming. You know, we'll fund a demonstration project, we'll pump prime it, show that it works, and then we'll get someone to sort of take over and scale it up and sort of make it work. And someone said, but the landscape is littered with rusty pumps. So I guess I'm almost sort of challenging this sort of this question of demonstration. I mean, this idea that we'll demonstrate that something works and then some partners elsewhere will sort of take it on. And I just wonder if we need to, I just wonder if the expectations of our partners have changed a little bit in the last couple of years, where we seem to be faced by bigger problems, so that demonstrating something works in the hope that someone else will scale it up. I just wonder if we need slightly different language. But as per usual with me, I don't quite know what the solution is.
Yeah. Well, and when we're using that phrase, usually what we are talking about is our experimenting together, applying catalytic thinking in a specific circumstance. So for instance, what we did with the Nevada Department of Education was looking at what happens when you apply catalytic thinking to systems-wide change throughout the entire education system throughout the state of Nevada. Experimenting to say, here's what it would look like to apply catalytic thinking to that. And the demonstration part of that is then what we do with that afterwards is to show and share everything that we've learned from that so that others can scale it however it makes sense to them from the thinking. And so when we're talking about demonstration projects, that's usually the way that we're thinking about it. And so I appreciate the clarity of language. When someone is thinking of playing with us, we want to do something fun together. We want to experiment on something. We want to apply catalytic thinking. We wanted to see what it would look like at NCBO if we applied catalytic thinking to the strategy you are using moving forward. And then we would like to share what we learned from that out in the world. What are the expectations of those really on the ground partners, not someone who's feeding the money into it, but on the ground partners, we're going to do something together. What are those expectations? What are those kinds of commitments?
I think the part of it is the expectation of doing it together and figuring out together.
Yeah.
There is, I think, you know, in what Carl is talking about, this distinction between investing in a program model versus an organization. We're talking about sort of this realm of trust philanthropy, where you just give an organization money and just let them run with it. It's literally a realm of philanthropy that they're defining with that label. that, you know, the Prime the Pump is, that is not an organization investment at all. That's a program investment. It's not taking into account what the organizing principle is around the body of work, which is so much of what we're talking about. I mean, that's what we're sort of thinking about, is how do we focus people's attention on the commitment that the organization is making, which means, you know, the program is just a jigsaw puzzle. It's different pieces that you may throw out because, hey, it didn't work. That's the experiment part of it. The demonstration is, it's like, we're going to try something. Okay. So again, the disclaimer that I'm going to go into the negative, but the reason we exist is because it's fucked up. It's because of failure. Like, so to sort of expect that there's this model of things working, right, that we're just waiting to like find to solve where everything didn't work is, you know, obscene. But to accept that these are wicked, complicated, interconnected pieces, which is so much at the heart of what creating the future is sort of embedded on or built upon. But sort of that recognition, I gotta figure out where I was going with this, if anywhere. I lost it. Sorry.
That's okay. It'll be back. But again, what we're not talking, let's focus on the partners that, so we have partnered with the Nevada Department of Education cooperatively on a program that together we built the program and executed the program together. So those kinds of partners, not someone who's investing as a silent financial partner in a thing, but that, as Angie said, that we will figure things out together as co-creators, co-developers, and co-doers of the project. If we were doing that with another entity, if we were doing that with whatever entity, pick one, if we were working together with independent sector to shift something in the sector, what would the expectation of that potential partner be of us?
Can I jump in just to build on that and what Justin was saying? Because it occurs to me there are two things, even though we have to do it together, each partner is coming with different kind of expertise areas. And I think that's important to think about. And then the other thing is, we're talking about experiments and working in the context of failure, but we also know, or we've done catalytic thinking, we know it works in a certain way, right? Like there are certain results that happen when we use that approach. And so and having some assurance that you will eventually get somewhere that is not going to be a failure is also important, especially when you think about partners. Like I'm thinking about, you know, our Nova hat, that, you know, we have limited resources, there are skeptical people that come to the table. You know, at some point you do have to have some assurance that something will be achieved or people won't even want to begin, you know?
Yes. Yes. That catalytic thinking will create the results that we say it will.
At least some kind of results. Like, you don't know exactly, right, what will come out of it. But that's an important thing. We need to trust the process, back to the trust, I guess, things that we've been talking about earlier.
So I guess there's something, and I wrote this down a little bit earlier, we were talking about outcomes, but I do think it's also the values.
Yes.
So some of it is, you know, if we profess a particular perspective around how we see reality, that our values and actions. So again, we're making a commitment to live those values, or to ensure that what we do reinforces what we say we value.
Huge.
And that's fundamental to trust, because, you know, if you say one thing and do another, trust is not built.
You know, Justin, you said something earlier, just had a little passing phrase, and I'm applying it and thinking about this in the concept of partnerships, and that you were talking about an employee who goes home and goes, wow, what a great place. I can't believe I'm working here. It's wonderful. It's fantastic. It's what I'm expanding a little bit on what you said. And that the organization do that. That if they, or whatever, the entities that partner, when they aren't partnering or when they aren't together, they are that excited about the idea that they're partnering. That, that it's bringing them as an entity that kind of spark, energy, joy. And to me, it all revolves around the why. You know, why are we here? Why are we doing this? What is our, you know, our total outcome? Our outcome is not that we're going to be a $1 billion entity, you know, 3 years from now, but that we're going to have $1 billion worth of world change that takes place because of catalytic thinking, because of spreading that. So it, I was just sort of thinking about that sort of energy and excitement that can, that you were referring, you were addressing to an employee or someone, the volunteer or whatnot. And I'm thinking of it, wow, what if the partner has that same kind of energy and thought?
Yeah, what that's raising for me is this, I like the word benefit here, is that that the expectation is that all of the partners, if it's two, if it's three, if it's four, that their missions will be advanced, that it will benefit the missions of all of the organizations that are partnering. Let's move on to employees and contractors of Creating the Future. What are the expectations and commitments? We can laughingly say that they'll get paid, and laughingly because our budgets are always so lean, but that there will be compensation for their work. What are the other expectations and commitments that we're making to that are expected by employees and contractors?
What happens when they're exactly the same as everybody else? I'm sort of looking at the list, and I said, well, they expect that in working with us, they achieve outcomes, that they experience the values, that they are benefiting in the ways that are necessary for them. So one of those will be financial, but there may be that professionally and personally, it advances what they are wanting to do.
Yeah. I think especially with Creating the Future, there is an expectation of learning and opportunities to practice catalytic thinking. I think with us specifically, that is.
So an expectation in both directions that you're talking about?
No, I'm talking specifically about the expectations of employees upon Creating the Future.
Probably it's being listened to, being, you know, sort of being heard, being acknowledged. So often employees are basically productivity widgets, sort of an understanding of what Creating the Future is and how their connection with it is important to them.
You don't need to answer immediately, Dimitri, but for those who don't know, Dimitri spent 12 years as a union negotiator, and I would love, with your labor hat on, for you to think about what are the expectations that an employee has of an employer. And like I said, you don't have to answer immediately because I know I'm just asking you now, but I think there's something also and I'm not going to be articulate. because it's not fully formed. But something about employees expect, and you want to talk, Justin, about the negative, some form of recourse. So I have a boss. I have an altercation with my boss or a disagreement with my boss or whatever, that there's somewhere else I can turn, that I'm not stuck, that I have somebody I don't know how to express it, but it's short of that, but that, that, you know, that is frequently an expectation of an employee, that I'm not just stuck with talking to my boss said no, and I'm done. And I don't know how else to, I mean, that's really down the negative rabbit hole, but I think that's I'm trying to reframe that in what good would look like.
So possibly reframing that, Hildy, is that people want dignity at work. That sort of sense that they're treated with respect and so on, but also where they sort of have, they're treated equally. But if they have problems, that there is recourse, as you say. I think the thing that I was going to suggest is that people want sort of meaning. They want to do work that is meaningful. Nobody wants to sort of spend whatever number of hours a week bashing bits of metal and thinking, well, all I did was sort of mean that the earth is heating up a degree for a bit more quickly than it would have done. And they also want mastery. They want to be good at what they do. And giving them the knowledge and skills and sort of insight enable them to be good at what they do. I'd suggest that when you're good at what you do, that's one of the things that also gives you meaning. And I think people want that from work these days, presuming, of course, that those other considerations like money are taken care of.
Now, given that, I think investment is seeing this relationship as an investment. So an investment in whatever the organization's mission is. An investment in my personal development, an investment in my personal happiness.
So we're really talking about two-way investment.
Right. That I think so often in workplace environments, there's a lot of lip service toward investing in the employees, but it's only a one-way kind of an investment. I'm investing in you because you're going to be better for me. As opposed to I'm investing in you because you being better for you, the picture really does make it better for you. But so frequently that's not what happens. And so having that, and I think Carl, dignity is a key word on it. And that sort of rotates around many, many different nodes then, because what defines it, many things define it. But I think that would be an expectation that an employee would have. And I do think that listening is a big part of it, being heard. You know, the recourse thing you're talking about is being heard.
Yes, yes.
So I think it's really important that there is a way, not only a way, but the feeling, genuinely, that you're being heard.
Yeah.
And that there is communication in that sense going both ways.
There needs to be a commitment from the organization to whoever, you know, employee, contractor, that they have all the necessary supports and resources to be successful in whatever role, function, responsibility I am a part of or leading or any of that. All conditions for that success, I think, is on the organization in ensuring that it's a steady state of such.
Oh my gosh, yes, yes. Yes.
So, yes, to what Rebecca said, if you think about the innumerable instances where the reason we're not succeeding is because we fail to support and invest in what it takes to succeed. Just simply like, I'm sorry, you don't get that. You don't get that computer because we don't have the money, but here, do everything you need to do.
So,
absolutely. I think you're right on there. Rebecca, I'd like to answer your question to Dimitri, Hildy, with something that Carl already answered, which is power. I mean, that's at the root, my understanding, that's the root of unions and organized labor is power. And to Carl's point about sort of this push now of re-understanding power, who holds power, and even what you were talking about, so my ability to have a grievance, it's actually efficacy. Do I have the power to affect
Thank you.
Positively the experience, the world I'm living in? And in this case, the organization, my job. And so if we really bring it back to that, is to say what we want as people, because it's true for all people, we want a sense of efficacy and we want dignity in that efficacy.
That's
awesome. And so that would be the expectation. I have power to influence this thing.
Yeah, that's the word. That's spot on. And I apologize for not asking you, who are a labor lawyer by osmosis.
I think they prefer rabble rouser.
I don't know. I'm not married to one, although I am sort of.
Yeah, I mean, there is something in creating the future that, to me, is anti-confrontation. And power dynamics in labor environments frequently are confrontational. And so I have sort of been training myself to not see it in a confrontational way. Yet it is a personal power that you're talking about. But in the labor sense, it ends up being a collective power. And it is a collective power that is frequently very confrontational because the power on the other side is not equal. So, you know, you butt up against a unwillingness to share power. And so it's an interesting way of shifting the thinking around what actually creates this power.
Power to do what? So let's talk about the power. Power to get what I need personally and professionally, power to do the work I need. Talk to me about the power dynamic.
Power to see that efficacy, justice, pain, relationship, all of that that would be normal in a friend's personal relationship is often not there in an employer-employee relationship. And so your power to have a life that is fulfilling is subject to other entities whose interests are not served by that or who don't care. And so the only way to maintain that power, get that power, may be to be confrontational.
There's power to make decisions, because we say that if people understand and are applying the catalytic thinking, decision-making framework, and being about the people, then these people out in the network, a collection of working on stuff, need to know with confidence, I'm applying this framework, and therefore I can make these decisions and feel confident in moving forward.
Right. Yes. Yeah, what I'm sensing is that there's power to do what I need to do for me, and power to do what I need to do for the organization. A lot of what you were talking about, Rebecca, in terms of having all of the conditions for success, for actually getting my work done. Power to make decisions is huge, which is why we're creating this thing that we're creating.
Carl, you're muted.
Yeah, sorry. There's an interesting point here, guys, that this is about being something that, say, the commercial sector is not. It's about doing things differently. You know, we are different, and you're laying out how we are different. So it isn't command and control in the way that it might be. It's not like, a statutory service in this country where at their worst they do things to people instead of doing things with people. That's what power is about in this context. It's, as you say, it's giving people power and control over their own lives and not doing things to them.
It is that big walking the talk thing. That if, you know, how many organizations do we see that are walking or doing their best to walk the talk in community of just what you said, Carl, working with rather than working for, but internally you're working for us. There's a piece here that we've been talking about as we've been talking over the past year about what we see this thing becoming, this structure becoming, of who's working for whom. Are you working for the organization, or is the organization here to make sure you have what you need to do what needs to get done so the organization's mission is served? So there's again, I think that's a power thing.
It's a bit like the big tech giants, the social media platforms. Facebook is the one I'm sort of thinking. Are we doing stuff for Facebook, supplying our data to them and so on, or are they doing something for us? Where's the power in that relationship? And my argument here is that as nonprofits, as civil society organizations, we would take a very different approach. We would put data and power in the hands of the individuals, and then the platform would serve their interests, not the other way around.
Want to build it?
Tim Berners-Lee apparently is trying to now.
Aren't those cooperatives? I mean, the model's there already for some of this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and so you're talking really about shared power, cooperative power, collective power, ideally. We have a few more minutes left. Let's talk about participants in our programs. What are the expectations and commitments that we would want to quote comply with, or that they are expecting us to commit to and comply to?
It's top of my mind at the moment because of issues that are going on here in the UK, but they have a right to be safe. In their interaction.
Safe, you define safe.
Physically safe, safe from harm. So for example, if there are vulnerable adults that you come into contact with, they have a right to be safe and to be safe from harm. So where compliance is important here is that whatever systems or rules we think are important to ensure that people are always safe, I think that is a bare minimum they should expect from us.
Feeling safe, absolutely. The thought that occurred to me is that if they're participating in our programs, that they will get out of it what we're saying they'll get out of it, that we do what we say we'll do. Back to Justin's all of the above. What else? What are the expectations of people who take our education programs or participate in a online community? And I think the safety is a big part, Carl. Thank you.
We're trying to play with the idea of what happens when you're in a movement. It's not a one-time thing. I mean, if you believe in X and you are taking this class because you believe in X, it's not over at the end of the class. And when you're an employee, it's not over when you go home at 5 or 9 or 9 or whatever it is. So that there's a different expectation of relationship.
What else? People who take a class, who may just take a class online, click and take a class. Someone who joins one of our immersion courses. Someone who is in one of our online communities on Facebook, at least right now on Facebook. What are the expectations and commitments?
So I think it's accessible and doable.
Talk to me.
So, you know, if I am, you know, fully employed, I can't take a class that is, you know, runs all day every Wednesday. So I think there is that it's reasonably doable. Whatever it is that I'm, you know, opting into. So I think, and that encompasses a lot. I mean, that's a logistics component, but it's also, it's meeting me where I am. It's not expecting me to know something I don't know, or it's not asking me to participate in something counter to what I believe or experience, which I think starts to then also tread over onto what Carl was saying around safety. So, you know, it will be culturally competent. It will be, I mean, again, I think about these sort of, again, it's I can engage with it with dignity, and it's doable, it's accessible. And then I think, you know, echoing what you said, Hildy, of I get a benefit.
Yeah, and I'm adding safety and inclusivity into the employees part. I think safety is a big piece in the employees part as well. I think the inclusivity is a big piece. I don't want to say getting bigger, gaining more attention of how important it is. I think that there is, it may not be an expectation because for so long it has not been reality, but I think that aspirationally, people seeing themselves in the people that they are in the programs both with and the people who are teaching the programs, that it is important for ethnic and racial and gender and et cetera, that people see themselves, that I'm not the only woman in a room, or someone is not the only man in a room, that et cetera and et cetera. I think that there's a really important piece there about, and again, I think that it is not an existing expectation because it's been so not that for so long. I had a delightful experience that I came home to tell Dimitri about because he was the one that created it. I was doing some work with a group in Florida, and there were PowerPoints. And our PowerPoints were very, very mindful to have gender and race and ethnicity, and just there's people in them. So we want, you know, people in down to cartoon characters. And a woman walked up to me after one of the presentations I did and thanked me. She said, "I never see myself on a screen. And you had 3 slides out of the 10 where I could see myself on the screen." And so I think that it's not an existing expectation. It may be aspirational, but it's certainly a reward when they do see it. And that it's really something that is deeply important to our mission. I mean, if a big piece of what we're about is meeting people where they are, it would be nice if we were meeting people with who they are.
Yeah,
Yeah, I'll just add, can I just add onto that maybe it's not an expectation amongst the mainstream majority, right, white culture or what have you, but it should, it probably is an expectation for the, you know, for people that we're just not aware of, right? We haven't been paying attention to.
We're blind to.
Yeah.
And what's so interesting is you know, in the story that I just shared, is that it wasn't, the expectation is that she was not going to see herself. That it was such a surprise to her and so meaningful to her that she did see herself, that the expectation was actually a negative expectation.
Well, and I think, Angie, on that is the expectation actually is there. It's just we're advantaged to being able to take it for granted, but it will happen. We will see ourselves. You know, that's just, so we don't even have to think about the expectation. We don't even have to think about the assumption that we have. And that's so much of the issues around privilege and advantage is it's the challenge of recognizing those expectations that you don't even codify as expectations. You just think it's norm. Yeah. It's not.
The blind spots.
That's it.
I also think that one of the, and again, you know, it sort of comes under the shoulds. It's an expectation that that people are consistently surprised with, which is that we will meet them where they are. So in terms of the accessible and doable, Justin, that we will meet people, that it's part of our work to meet people where they are as best we can in whatever ways we can, but that we will at least make the effort to meet people where they are. Anything else that occurs to you in terms of expectations of the people who participate in our programs?
I'm not sure that this is quite what you're looking for, but fun, conviviality. Sometimes, you know, I mean, some of this stuff, it's so serious all the time, you know, I mean, for very good reasons, but actually, you know, when people just want conviviality from voluntary action, it's one of the things that makes those connections that we sort of talked before were just so important to sort of how we do things differently.
Yes, sir. Yeah, the rule around here is if there's a whole meeting and I don't hear laughing, something's wrong. Well, I cannot believe our time is up. I want to go back to the picture that we started with today. And the importance of really identifying when we're talking about compliance and expectations and commitments, to whom are we fulfilling expectations and commitments? And really listening for, and we've been asking it and talking about it today, is through that lens of outcomes rather than what's wrong, values of what's important, why these things are important. And when we get together next time, we'll start looking at, okay, what does good look like for those people and what needs to be in place for that to happen? What are the conditions that will lead to that? And that really gets into the meat of, if this is what good would look like, what do people need to feel? What do they need to have? What do they need to know? What do they need to be assured of? In compliance, I think the one of the biggest conditions questions is going to be, what do people need to be assured of What do they need to have and know and feel? And so we'll start diving into that part of the framework next time, looking again at all of the people that we talked about today, the expectations of externally, the IRS, state law, the people who are investing in our mission in whatever way, potential partners in projects, employees and contractors, participants in our programs. And that's where we will head. We will continue using the framework, and out of that will come the various roles and functions of what a quote unquote compliance-based board. And you know, maybe you know, I like going back to the word choice that we talked about at the beginning, and Justin, you talking about compliance being something that, you know, it is a negative. It's not who we are. And maybe what comes out of this is we find another word for what this really is, because it really is not who we are. It really is about creating conditions for success for all of these people with various expectations of what we are going to be. And so what I'm going to ask now in our last remaining time is that if you took some notes, take a look at them. If you've got thoughts that have been bubbling for you, and that we take some time to reflect and share what has been standing out for you. Maybe something that struck you in particular, an aha. Maybe something that you think we didn't talk about and might want to include next time. And let's share those. Mr. Wilding.
So I'm going to kick off with your and Justin's point at the end about compliance. I prefer accountability.
And he's blipping out of here.
The way that we divide all us.
You're back.
The way that we divide all our groups up into sort of partners and funders and so on, that quite frequently I think their interests will overlap, and indeed they may be the same people at times. So I sort of almost wonder if sometimes we can sort of shorten that sort of process. And then I guess my final observation is that I think we need to be really careful that we don't end up trying to please everybody. Because I think what I take from this discussion is that you can't, and that we need to think about who is the most important group of stakeholders that we want to be accountable to. And my argument to you is that's the communities that we're trying to benefit. And then I think that will lead on to those important questions about what's the best way to be accountable.
Beautiful. Thank you.
I have, I guess, three themes that really jump out for me in terms of, again, sort of this body of things that we're talking about. And I think it transcends even the four homes. It's sort of this seems to be true, is that we're looking at, I think, systems that ensure, or a system that ensures at the values level, dignity and efficacy. People are experiencing dignity and efficacy. And I think that really gets at the power issue there. And then there's a whole element of how you make that possible, but that's what we're preserving. There is the legal compliance. There are rules we have to follow, so we need to make sure we're following those rules. And then the other one, I think going back to what I had said earlier, is we have systems for determining benefit. We'll figure out the word, but which also ties into the power conversation too. But are we ensuring that there are systems in place to determine benefit, so that then we have a systems of accountability that ensure that benefit is actually manifesting? And again, it's a big piece, I know I'm sort of jumping ahead and thinking about what a board would look like. But those are the three things that really, sort of the realms that we're talking about, of the kinds of who benefits and how.
Great. Always love your the fact that your brain has to pull things together. Because I know the next thing comes out of that is always a graphic. So I'm not always... Anyone else? Angie, Rebecca, Dimitri, what is standing out to you all?
Rebecca, you want to go or do you... I thought you were going to click that.
You unmuted first. I was heading... You saw me.
I guess just to add a little bit more to thinking about, especially Carl's point about accountability and accountability to beneficiaries, I think it's also in connecting to our discussion about, you know, when we're even thinking about, when we're thinking about beneficiaries, who are those beneficiaries? And I guess talking to them directly about what they think and need, beyond just what we think about that, because we are limited by our own awareness and biases and so on.
Yep.
I just was thinking about just in a general kind of big umbrella of here's what you can expect, you, whichever human being you are in this entire world, and the power of also acknowledging, and Carl spoke to some of the current systems in which people may not even see that they've been operating it in all their entire life. Command and control, stay in your box, you don't make decisions. And the power in us holding up all of those systems to say, all of this may feel very different because this is a different way of being, and here's what you can expect, and here is our commitment. And then, yes, there is the subset that will be around the compliancy stuff, but that's not the overarching presentation of this framework of here's what we are about, and we just as much want to know what you are about.
Yeah, I love that. And I'm already imagining how different a board's work would be if it is about that piece. Yeah. Dimitri, what's standing out to you?
There's like three or four things that we were talking about today that sort of have stuck with me. One of them was a comment that, or phrase that Carl used, was reducing the social distance. And I was thinking about that in basically in all of these for whoms, reducing the social distance in every one of these contexts. So it, between volunteers and staff and partners and funders and whatever, what does it take to do that? And next step to that was a commitment to, which is what Justin said, a commitment to values and action. And I was thinking about it, well, that leads to that. That these are our values, and part of our values is reducing that social distance, which is really, at the end, I was thinking about, well, this is a social contract. You know, this is a contract that we're creating and that we're working with, and that, you know, this is what our commitment is that social contract with all of these organisms. And the contract, all contracts go two ways. So it is not just to you, it is you back to us. So those are some of the things that were standing out for me today.
Yeah, I love what, Carl, I can't wait to click on some of the links that you provided. That's one of my reflections is, you've got this stuff at your fingertips. I don't know how you do it, but the reducing social distance, starting with governance. Yes, please. Yes, please. Yes, please. Yeah, Justin.
So, sorry, but just sort of this round of Angie and then Rebecca and Carl and that comment, what really is standing out for me, and we've talked about this before, but it's becoming so clear, is we're talking about governance or the board as a system rather than a set of actions. And it's always talked about as actions. Governance is actually a set of actions. You're going to decide this, you're going to, and that's the problem to Angie's point, which is if we have a board deciding what the benefit is, well, unless the board is the community, you already have that social distance issue. And so what happens when we stop thinking that the board is actually that? So rather than the board being the gears of the engine, the board is the lubricant. The board is not making decisions about how it works. They're helping facilitate it working in a particular way, which really, you know, speaks to it from much more of a systems perspective than a body of actions. So I'll stop there.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, ensuring that it is happening, ensuring that the systems are doing what we have, this body of stuff that we're saying we want the systems to do. And you know, the question of who's watching over to make sure that, okay, you said you're going to do that. Who's making sure you are? What's striking me in the conversation is the, and you really struck it, Rebecca. And you know, we've all said it in different ways, that what's good for one is good for everybody. You know, short of the legal compliance, which truly is the bare minimum, that this is about how we be with each other, and that how we view with each other is how we be with each other, and it doesn't matter who. And that's just really striking to me. I'm excited for next time. We will meet in April. Our meeting will be the second Monday in April on the 8th. I believe by then, Carl, your daylight savings time will have caught up with our daylight savings time. Here in Arizona, where we don't change clocks at all, we don't care where you guys go. It's always the same time for us. So deeply, deeply grateful to everyone. And we will see you next month. And hopefully we'll have a bigger room. I was socked in this month and could not do a lot of inviting, but I will urge each of you, if there are people you know who are curious about different ways of having discussions in board meetings, who are curious about organizational design, invite them. We will bring them up to speed. But if there's anybody that you know that you say, you know what, they would love to be in this room. That's what I do throughout the month is if I'm in conversation with somebody who's talking about something, it's like, come on, you'll enjoy this. And so I would urge you and anybody who may be watching, I would urge you as well to jump on in and invite others to join us. And we will see you all next month. Thank you guys for a great conversation.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye. See you later. Hildy,
we'll talk to you.
We will indeed. Thanks, Angie. Bye-bye.